Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud, on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
I'm Candy Shannon, host of Morning Brew, the Friday edition, from 5 to 8 a.m. on member-supported WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM.
What role can the military play in an authoritarian regime? And one brave coach stood between ICE agents and his team players. Yeoman Wilder joins us. Stay with us. Good morning. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, if we turn the title of this show into a question, that answer would be quite simply, our very democracy in the United States of America is at stake. Surveys of hundreds of political scientists and prominent scholars have concluded that the Donald Trump administration is inching the U.S. towards authoritarianism control. Though the process and form differ from classic dictatorships, leading scholars like Stephen Levitsky, Lucan Wei, and Daniel Ziblatt argue the U.S. has already entered a phase of competitive authoritarianism. In other words, maintaining the appearance of elections and constitutional order, but hollowing out checks and balances on executive power. The U.S. Congress, for example, rubber stamps all of Trump's immigration policies, widely unpopular bills advantaging the rich, and poorly thought out tariff actions, no matter how extreme. And the U.S. Supreme Court, which is designed to be a check on executive power, is stacked with obedient Trump appointees ruling consistently in his favor, while also increasing his power to a level of broad immunity from criminal prosecution for acts performed as president. Not placing him fully above the law, but close to it. And a competitive authoritarianism diminishes the capacity of independent institutions like universities and the media to resist the ruling estate, the ruling elite. President Barack Obama has warned that the United States is, quote, dangerously close to normalizing behavior that is more often seen in authoritarian governments. Trump has deployed law enforcement and military forces domestically against the will of local authorities, a move which has been challenged in court as against the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. And ultimately, a federal appeals court ruled in Trump's favor. All this calls into question who or what can check an authoritarian's power and what role, if any, does the military play? After all, it's under the command of the commander-in-chief, in this case, Donald Trump. According to some experts, the military can play a decisive role in either upholding or ending authoritarian regime, depending on its actions during moments of political crisis. Such actions, I would imagine, relies on the decisions made by the individual man or woman in uniform. And that's the discussion we'll have this morning on What's at Stake. Joining us are Laura Dickinson, professor of law at GW University and author of Outsourcing War and Peace. Attorney Gene Fidel teaches military justice at Yale Law School. And Commander Bobby R. Jones, president of Veterans for Responsible Leadership. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Professor Dickinson, let's pretend I'm a service member in uniform. Let's say I'm in the National Guard, and I feel like Trump ordering us to enter LA and maintain crowd control against the governor's wishes is violating the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, and I can, in good conscience, carry out the commander-in-chief's orders because I believe it to be illegal. What options do I have? I can't just not show up for duty. I'm sure there are criminal penalties for that, starting with insubordination. So tell us, what options does a service member have?
Well, I mean, I think Jean can speak to this as well. I mean, the problem is that it's legally ambiguous, right? This federalizing the National Guard in LA, sending in the Marines, this is out of keeping with our constitutional tradition. Presidents of both parties have only done this as a last resort when the governor has not consented, when there's been a complete breakdown of law and order. You don't have that here. So this is really an over-militarization of a situation. However, it's out of keeping with our tradition, but it's not manifestly unlawful, as you can see by the fact that you have a district court decision suggesting that it was unlawful. But the Court of Appeals, at least as a preliminary matter, deferring to the president's interpretation of a statute that he was using as the basis for federalizing the National Guard. So it puts the military in a really difficult situation. And that's what I want to emphasize. It's a crime not to follow lawful orders, but you're also not supposed to follow manifestly unlawful orders. So it really puts the military in a difficult situation. But I think it's hard to say it's manifestly unlawful in a situation like this. And so the military does have to follow orders. That being said, you're putting the military in a really volatile situation, right, that they're not necessarily trained for, right? The Marines are trained to fight foreign wars. The National Guard, they get some training in local law enforcement type issues, but it's uneven. And they're on a mission here to defend federal property and personnel, but they could be drawn into volatile situations. And there's a risk that they could be drawn into a situation where mm-hmm. they do something unconstitutional, and that's where it could come up. But the problem is that it's legally ambiguous.
Okay, so and it's manifestly unlawful. So, but
it's not clear that it's manifestly unlawful. So they've got to follow orders here.
They have to show up.
Absolutely.
In other words, if I'm a service member, I have to show up.
Yes.
So, what is the directive to service members regarding following illegal orders?
Well, I'm going to let Gene take that one.
Okay. Thanks, Laura. I'm going to cover quite a bit of ground here, so bear with me. Basically, there's a statute on this. The statute is the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which does create a legal, criminally punishable provision that requires military personnel to comply with lawful orders. So as Laura pointed out, that means the sort of critical juncture here is actually not, who's best suited for anything. The critical question is, what's lawful and what isn't lawful? And I'll just give you some examples that may be helpful to sort of put this in perspective. Suppose you're the piccolo player in the Marine band. Okay? John Philip Sousa, all that stuff. And you get an order to show up at a political rally. Suppose the president is running for office again, and he or she would like the Marine band to play. That's nice, the colorful uniforms, all that stuff. And you're the piccolo player, and you say, and your significant other is a law student. And your significant other says, wait a minute, the Marine band isn't supposed to play at political events. And you say, well, yeah, I guess that's an illegal order, so I don't have to follow it. Well, obviously, that's a trivial example, but mm-hmm. but you can see how, there are some fuzzy aspects. Basically, I'm going to give a summary here, and please, anybody on this call, correct me if you disagree with the summary. But the summary is, if you're talking about questions of legality, what I'll call the wholesale or policy level, you're really tempting fate, meaning you're really asking for a court-martial. Let me give you some examples. There was an Army doctor named Lakin, L-A-K-I-N. Dr. Lakin was a birther. Remember the birthers? They thought that President Obama was not eligible to be president. because he was born someplace other than the United States, and therefore orders he was giving for various deployments and so forth didn't have to be followed. Well, Dr. Lakin wound up being charged for disobedience because he refused to deploy. Okay, that's an example. There was another doctor, a woman named Hue Vaughn, H-U-E-T Vaughn, who disobeyed in order to deploy somewhere. I forget whether it was Iraq or Afghanistan, because she didn't agree with the policy. There was a GI named Michael New, N-E-W. Michael New objected to the fact that his deployment would require him to wear a UN beret instead of the normal U.S. uniform cap. And he was an objector on the ground that that was an unlawful order, and he wound up losing that. There was a lot of litigation, but he wound up losing it. Losing it means going to jail, potentially. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, if very briefly, and then I'll be done. Mm-hmm. What if you get an order that you have doubts about? Okay, you're curious. You're in a jam if it's an order that requires immediate compliance. You don't have time to discuss it. You don't have time to say to the captain, I think that order may be unlawful. Mm-hmm. You don't have time to pick up the phone and try to find the lawyer in the moment. That's the problem.
Yes.
That's the nub of the issue. Let me stop there, but I've thrown a lot of
ideas. You've given us a lot to chew on. So it sounds like there's really nothing that the service member can do on the spot that is legal that would prevent him or her from facing penalties.
Not quite. You can say, Captain, I really think that order is unlawful. Or
but what's going to happen as a result of that?
Captain is going to say, thanks very much. I really appreciate your insight. Yes. Now, do as I told you.
Exactly. So the law allows the president to call in troops to protect federal property. Is D.C. and either one of you considered federal property? So if a riot broke out in D.C., would Trump have the authority to call off the National Guard? And I should say, I'm old enough, unfortunately, to remember when the National Guard was called out in D.C. during the riots in the 60s. Professor Dickinson, yes.
So D.C. is a special case, and the president has direct control over the use of the National Guard in D.C., unlike the states where the governors have control in the first instance, unless the president invokes an authority to federalize the National Guard and put them under his control. So D.C. is a special case. But again, I just want to come back to this point that the way the National Guard are being used in L.A., again, to be sent there without the governor's consent, when the state and local authorities have things mostly in hand, mostly peaceful protests, it's very much out of keeping with our tradition. But we can't say it's manifestly unlawful, and that's what's so difficult.
And the courts decided to, they sided with Trump.
Well, it's not clear ultimately how it will end because, this is all on preliminary proceedings. Mm-hmm. And the district court thought that the president did not have authority because the statute says, if it's an invasion or a rebellion, mm-hmm. and said, reading the plain meaning of those words, we don't have that. What the Ninth Circuit said, the Court of Appeals said, is that the president gets some deference in interpreting the meaning of the word rebellion, right? The courts have to defer to some degree. So that's still being litigated, the extent. Mm-hmm. But it's not manifestly unlawful. But what I want to come back to is this point that when you put the military in that situation, and military, they've said they're not doing direct law enforcement, like arresting people, they're defending federal property. But this is, and federal personnel, but these are volatile situations. Mm-hmm. And where this illegal orders issue could come up is if someone were to order the military to use force in a way that violated people's constitutional rights. Again, the military, they're not trained in the first instance for doing these kinds of operations for the most
part. Okay. Let me just say, I want to bring Commander Bobby R. Jones into this discussion because he has real life experience with these type of things. You're retired now, Commander, but you served as a UN peacekeeper in Liberia. Did you or any members of your unit ever face a situation where you were conflicted over how you were performed in an instance? What are your thoughts about this?
First of all, thank you for having me. And both our law experts here are raising some valid points. However, I think there are some details that are lacking. So you mentioned I was a United Nations peacekeeper in Liberia during my career at one point, and that is true. Understand, we have about 2 million people on active duty. No more than 30, as in 30, are United Nations peacekeepers at one time. I was selected and I had to go through a separate pipeline of training. The United States Armed Forces is not designed nor trained to be a peacekeeping force or what we call conventional law enforcement officer duties. That is not why we exist, right? So before I went to Liberia, and this is in the aftermath of the Civil War where children were used as soldiers, I had to go through months of training. Why? Because I never got that type of training in my active duty deployment training cycles. So when the second that I heard that they were sending Marines to Los Angeles, I literally said, this is literally going to pour gasoline on a fire that is really not big at all. The amount of surface area that they're talking about when Trump did this deployment was what, 2 to 3 city blocks, right? But if you know anything about the United States military, part of the reason we're effective is just our presence changes things. The visuals change things. And Trump wanted that imposed on the American citizens. You've got to understand, this is not about even policy. It's about the optics of oppression, cruelty, to stoke fear. And the military historically has never been domestically pretty much used for that, except for extreme, extreme circumstances. Think 1968, you know, Democratic Convention in Chicago, those extreme situations. What we're watching right now is a normalization of a power that is not designed to be imposed on its citizenry. The Marines that were deployed, right, had no training on this stuff. As a matter of fact, you know, you can ask various reports, people have started to leak it out. You know, they saw some PowerPoint slides. Well, military uses this thing called rules of engagement, right? And I never thought I would live long enough to actually hear rules of engagement and American citizens and domestic soil in the same paragraph. But here we are. The Marines deployed, and just by them being there, right, the situation that scared me was, what happens if an E3 Marine, you know, a Lance Corporal or Corporal, is confronted by a protester? They only think in the rules of use of deadly force. That's what we train them to do. We don't have de-escalation. We don't have all of these things that a local sheriff or a local police officer is trained and certified to do. Anytime military forces deploy around the world, we have to go through a training cycle that demonstrates our ability to execute whatever mission, and we have to get certified. Let me say that again, certified before we leave to do the mission. There was no such certifications under Task Force 54 for NORTHCOM for those Marines to do that.
Commander, you've been on both sides of this scenario, having to follow orders, I would imagine, earlier in your career, and actually giving the orders. What do you recommend a member does in a moment of indecision?
Well, and this is part of the nuance that I referred to earlier. I'm going to be honest, it depends on the rank of the actual service member. So for example, the enlisted military members take a different oath than the officer military members, okay? The enlisted take an oath that says support, defend the Constitution of the United States, and to obey the orders of the president and the officers appointed above me. The officers do not have the clause of obeying the orders of the president in their oath. That is by design, because it's the officers who are held responsible for making sure that lawful orders are used in any type of scenario. Meaning, if we know something violates, say, the Geneva Conventions, going all the way back to the 1920s, it is the officer, and it could be a very junior officer, 22 years old, 21 years old, that is supposed to be the one saying that's an unlawful order. Now, do they risk his or her career by doing that? Absolutely. But there is a reason we have two separate oaths. The military is ran by professionals. However, we take orders from civilians. So we are subjected to policy from a political standpoint. However, the world, and I mean the world, Geneva, and from that point on, has had rules come into play saying what militaries can and cannot do around the world. And it is up to those officers to make that determination. Now, what has happened in the modern day is we usually have Judge Advocate Generals, JAGs, that deploy with us. So if we have any questions of legality, we're able to ask it. However, when Trump came in office this time around, he fired the head JAG of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, decapitating any type of legal resistance that could be provided to on-ground commanders. This is why the current state of affairs should terrify people, because we've never had that happen before.
So
now you're looking at a whole new group of lawyers that are coming in who may be more loyal to the ideology of Trump and not the actual legality of action.
And so in a rapidly developing situation, I'll give you a chance, Professor Dickinson, where even momentary hesitation can mean death and defeat, the presumption of legality is essential. But what should a member do? I mean, you're saying the difference between an enlisted person and an officer.
I know what I would do personally. You know,
officer. Are you an officer?
Okay. Yes, I was an officer. Retired. I was a commanding officer.
No, I'm saying this scenario,
as an officer, I know I would hesitate and not probably follow the order. However. Wow. As well, but at the same time, I understand the ramifications of that action. That's called leadership. You don't, it's a hard job. Now, if I'm enlisted, though, if the officers are like, hey, do it, 9 times out of 10, they're going to probably do it, unfortunately. They don't have the training. They don't have the situational awareness of the legal portions of it because they're not trained to have it, which I think is part of the reason why they wanted to deploy military to this situation. When Trump said back in the 2017 administration, why can't we just shoot these guys in the leg? That right there showed you how he viewed the American military and its relation to the citizenry. He does not care about those things. But guess what? Me as an officer, me as a general or an admiral, I better care because I will still be held accountable for that. And there's no reset button once those rounds leave a chamber.
Professor Dickinson, you wanted to weigh in.
Yes, I wanted to follow up on some of those excellent points made by Commander Jones, just about the legal conundrum and the moral conundrum that this puts service members in if that kind of situation were to arise. Because as he was saying so powerfully, right, most of the training is to fight in foreign wars where you have rules for using force in war, which allows for more force to be used than if you were doing using force on U.S. soil, right? The Constitution applies and excessive force is manifestly unlawful, right? Any excessive force, shooting people in the legs, that would be manifestly unlawful. The Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, all the constitutional rights that people have are present. But so when you put the military in a situation there where they're not trained for that kind of nuance and understanding how to use force, if they're called upon to use it, that puts them in a really risky situation, caught between, you know, the fact that it's criminal not to follow orders because of good order and discipline, maintaining good order and discipline, and the need to follow the Constitution. This is very damaging, I would argue, for the military. And I would also note, this is contrary to all of our norms, right, that you would put the military in a situation like this in our history. The military is one of the few institutions in American society that enjoys broad-based respect across political parties, mm-hmm. And putting the military in this type of situation risks destroying that, damaging that, politicizing the military, and eroding the very important trust that Americans have in the military. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, Attorney Fidel, there have been cases throughout history where servicemen and women have been confronted with difficult decisions. Which one stands out the most for you?
Long pause.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this.
Maybe I can help I'll get to your issue, okay? But I think I can add something that may be worthwhile with your permission.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. There are, first of all, I should mention that my active duty was in the U.S. Coast Guard, which was the only armed force that where the officers and petty officers, non-coms, have law enforcement status. Any petty officer in the Coast Guard and any commissioned officer and any warrant officer is a federal law enforcement officer. Now, I will tell you, most Coast Guard personnel never get to exercise their law enforcement powers. And those that do, or that can be expected to, have serious training before they exercise those functions. It dates back to Alexander Hamilton and the Revenue Cutter Service and collecting taxes on imports, that kind of thing. But this is a matter, the training piece is a very important matter not to be taken lightly. That's point one. The second point is, in terms of what a person can do who is concerned, including commanders, by the way, they may not have access to a JAG. They may not have access to a JAG in real time. They may not have access to a JAG who is in a position to render independent or impartial advice, particularly given the current climate where the administration has installed some JAGs after having, you know, fired some for no apparent reason. One thing they can do is avail themselves of the services provided by something called the Orders Project. The Orders Project is part of the National Institute of Military Justice, which is a private NGO, and it has what we call a posse of former JAGs who are willing to make themselves available to GIs who have these kinds of questions for, you know, competent legal advice. You hope that it's not, you know, in an emergency situation, but it may be. You never know. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. the whole point. But anyway, getting back to your question.
Real quick, because we're running down on time.
There are situations. I mean, the Kent State shootings. When was that? 1970, am I thinking? Thereabouts. People knew or should have known that the order to shoot the students was wildly unlawful. But, you know, an E4, the junior enlisted personnel, they're not lawyers usually. So what are they supposed to do?
So what do they do?
They may roll the dice. They may say, Captain, I'm not following that order. Take me to court martial if you want, and I'll see you in the court martial. Now, that kind of decision should not be made without having consulted an attorney.
So, and I'm going to throw this out to whoever wants to respond. What role does the military play in an authoritarian regime in the 2 minutes we have left? Who wants to take that?
I'll take it real quick. So historically speaking, in the United States, zero. When George Washington at the end of the Revolutionary War turned his sword over at the Annapolis State House and went back to Mount Vernon, that was a clear delineation between military and civilian governance. And that is why, from that tradition, you have never seen a military coup in the United States of America. Mm. What we are seeing is the undoing of that separation on purpose, because the one thing Donald Trump has figured out, his administration has figured out, the military's quick, swift response, overwhelming force, and unbelievably impactful visuals helps the propaganda war. It helps install fear. And most importantly, it circumvents all of the other checks and balances that are supposed to be there when the military is used for law enforcement capability. It's not a coincidence that you're seeing the alligator Alcatraz and all these other things happening, because when resistance comes up, he wants America to be used to the United States military to roll in. And that is not how we do business in this country.
That was retired Commander Bobby R. Jones, President of Veterans for Responsible Leadership, former UN peacekeeper in Liberia, war games planner for the Missile Defense Agency, commanding officer of Maritime Expeditionary Security Squadron 4, and executive officer of USS Anzio. Also joining us for this segment was attorney Gene Fidel, who teaches military justice at the Yale School of Law, and Professor Laura Dickerson, professor at George Washington University and the author of Outsourcing War and Peace. Thank you all for a very informative and engaging discussion.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, indeed. After this short break, when ICE agent showed up at his team's practice, one brave coach understood his assignment to protect the students in his care. Yeoman Wilder joins us. Stay with us.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of July 14, 2025. On Thursday, July 17th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa Video Books and Cafe presents Dream Sis, The Live Experience. Mindfully envision your next chapter and color your stress away. An evening of connection, expansive dreaming, and coloring. Featuring author and founder, Dr. Michelle C. Chapman, located at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, please visit sankofa.com. On Sunday, July 20th, the Washington Area Bicyclist Association and the D.C. Trail Ranger Program host a series of events on Oxen Run Trail in Southeast Washington, D.C., including a block party and basketball activation aimed at encouraging people to get active and use the parks. A day full of activities and games will take place at James E. Bunn Amphitheater at Mississippi Avenue Southeast. For more info, feel free to visit waba.org. WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, beginning today, farm workers across the U.S. are launching a three-day nationwide strike in direct response to a wave of recent ICE raids and deportations. They're calling for an end to ICE raids and deportations. Yesterday, ICE reported over 969 arrests in a single day, allegedly targeting undocumented immigrants with criminal records and including gang leaders. However, due process, which every individual in the U.S. is entitled to, has been seriously eroded under the Trump administration. Therefore, it's really undetermined if those being arrested have criminal records or not. A farm worker who fell from a greenhouse roof during a hectic, chaotic ICE raid last week at a California cannabis facility died of his injuries. Damie Alanis, 57, is the first known person to die during one of the Trump administration's ongoing immigration enforcement operations. According to his niece, Alanis had worked on the farm for 10 years and was sending earnings back to his wife and daughter in Mexico. Officials indicated that ICE agents will expand their operations to New York with a target list that may include over 1 million people. Trump has vowed to target blue states in New York. Many nonviolent immigrants, including those outside their places of work and worship, as well as high schoolers and college students, have been caught in the Trump administration's mass deportation efforts. Last month, when a group of ICE agents rolled up on students in the Harlem Baseball Hitting Academy practicing in the Upper West Side, they ran smack into a wall of resistance. Coach Yeoman Wilder noticed the agents talking to his kids from a distance and immediately became involved. Coach Wilder is our guest this morning on What to Stay. Good morning, Coach Yeoman Wilder, and thank you for joining us on What to Stay.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So, Coach, take us back to that afternoon. I read where your students were practicing in the battle cages, and you were off at a distance. What happened?
Well, we had finished. We usually do about two and a half hours of practice every day. The rule is once my iPhone is finished, because we record every practice. We've done it for 20 years. If you look on our YouTube channel, we probably have 40,000 practices on there. So we practice everything so I can look at everything at the end of the day. So once I saw, you know, once that was done, I went over to shoot some basketball. And, you know, my kids are, the practices are ending. You know, they're kind of just mulling around and getting ready to leave. And I turn around and there I just see these agents speaking to my kids. And I'm like, whoa. So I ran over there and I'm hearing things of where you're from, where's your mom from, are you from here, you speak English? You know, and I just said, these are really inappropriate questions. So I'm going to ask them to invoke their Fifth Amendment right and for them not to have to say anything to you.
So how many agents were there? And how do you know there were ICE agents? How do you know there were ICE agents?
There were six. Well, they had these things that said ICE on the front and police on the back. Mm-hmm. So, and they looked the part. I had seen some of the things happen up in Washington Heights. It was about 2 miles up from where I live in Harlem. And I saw it in person. And they were the same agents and the same people who were up there during the earlier time that I'd seen them.
So you told the kids, don't answer that. And how did the agents react to your telling the kids not to respond?
Well, the first thing, you know, I had to do is make sure that I knew I could not win that battle by screaming. So talking law. And just stating that, you know, these kids have rights. You can't circumvent their Fifth Amendment right. You can't circumvent and you can't search them. You know, that's the Fourth Amendment right they have. And asking people who were born and raised here, who have a 14th Amendment right to 17 in this country, was incredibly weird to me as well. So they just kept moving, you know, a poll and asking questions that just were just weird, crazy, and I just had to say, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. And they just kept moving the goalposts, and I just kept moving the goalposts with them.
Well, that was some very specific legal language you were using. Most people wouldn't necessarily know that their Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights shielded them from having to answer their questions. Are you a lawyer?
No, but I have a law degree. I have a master's of law degree.
Okay. So they kind of rolled up on the wrong coach, I would think. What's the racial makeup of your team, Coach?
That day, you know, this is our 21st year. So the makeup of our is usually about 60% African-American, 35%, you know, percent of Latino, and 5% of everything else. That day, these are our younger kids who have just come into our academy. So we had some kids from Africa. We had some kids from Central America, Mexican kids. So that was daunting that they would come to us. Now, we're up in, you know, Lily, Upper West Side, 72nd Street and Riverside Avenue, which is very, very white, very, very upper middle class. And we're down where they are. And I just think it was a targeted situation where they looked at it and said, these are some Africans, these are some Latinos, possibly, you know, let's see what we have here.
So you just basically said, no, this is inappropriate. And the agents just accepted that and walked away? Did they?
No, they were. First, they said that they would cuff me for obstruction. And I said obstruction is actually a physical thing. So me telling them about their rights is not obstruction. You know, she has to go to First Amendment, you know, with that type of thing. And so it was a thing where I just kept enforcing, they have rights. This is the Constitution. I just remembered the only thing I have is my faith in this Constitution. And that's all I have to hold on to.
So and your faith on your Constitution. What was, were you afraid at that moment? I mean, there were six agents there with, did they have weapons on them? Or?
Yes, yeah, of course. Yes. Okay. Was I afraid? I was more afraid of the fact that they could take one of these kids and hold them and bring a father and mother in. And next thing you know, are you here legally? Are you here now, you know, and so forth like that. And now the whole family is taken out of here. So my whole thing, I was just going all over the place. You know, this happened for about 4 to 5 minutes. And mm-hmm. you know, you're trying to deal with everything. I have two agents talking to me. I got four of the agents screaming at everybody else. And then I have these kids in the back of the cages. And I'm telling them as I went back, I'm like, listen, there's only one way to get into this cage and one way to get out. If I will hold them off, but you guys, there's a fence over here. You know, I'm from Brooklyn. Jump that fence and get out of here.
Mm-hmm. So did the agents ever threaten you personally?
This was obstruction and that they would cuff me if I kept interfering with their investigation. And my whole thing is like, okay, but they've implemented their Fifth Amendment right. There's no more investigation.
Mm-hmm. So, Coach, what was going through your mind at that time when you were experiencing this?
I looked at them and it was like this. I don't care. I don't care what you say. I don't care what you have to, what right they have, what non-right they have. I don't care. And it just came up very much like, we're here and, you know, we'll do what we want to do.
Hmm. I heard you say on another interview that your mother's voice was in your ear, was in your head.
Always. You know, my mom, you know, was born in 1943. No rights. So to fight for those rights and to understand that people walk through the back door so I could walk the front doors. So you have to stand up. And that's what I heard.
Were there other people there? Were there parents there waiting for their kids after practice or people in the park?
No, most of our kids get around on the 5 bus and the 1 train. So it's an easy shot to Washington Heights and Harlem. It's just, you know, so most parents, we have kids whose parents have to work 2 or 3 jobs. Mm-hmm. So the great thing is over the years, we've always been very inclusive about everybody. And most of all, we've always taken care of our kids. So if she says, I'm having a problem, could you make sure he gets home? You know, I'm like, he's going my way. So they'll take the train with me or the bus with me. Or sometimes we'll even run, you know, where we have to go to. So
what about other people there in the park? Were there other people?
People were there in the park. And that's what the other four agents were talking, telling them, you want some of this? And basically, it came off like this. We'll detain you if we need to have your information, if we need to have you part of this. I remember them saying to people, are you part of this? Do you want to be part of this? And just people just backing up.
So they were threatening the onlookers.
Oh, definitely. And you know, at first I was a little mad. But then you realize that these are older people, you know. So you want to give some grace to that. But then you have people who just don't know. You know, this is so quick, so fast, and so explosive. It was very explosive. It, you know, very much like they were warriors, and we're not going to understand it. And they were quick. It was just quick.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you say you were mad, what were you mad about?
I was mad at the fact that we could not get these people to understand that these children had a right. And I was just mad at the fact that we were just singled out. You know, we were just singled. It just felt we were singled out. And I was really mad at that, which is really crazy because we've been going down there for 2 or 3 years, never had a problem. And I just felt that this is so wrong. Mm-hmm. You know?
And so eventually the agents just left.
I said to them, they do not have more rights than these kids, and these kids don't have less rights than they do. And he then called me a YouTube lawyer. And the next thing, you know, they talked for like 10, 15 seconds, and they just turned and left. They were walking out with a fence there, and it's a road, and they just started walking out. And I just told my kids, get out of here. Mm. Just get out of here.
So, Coach Yeoman Wilder, you were literally the only thing standing between those young boys on the team possibly being arrested and shipped off to the Alligator Alcatraz Detention Center.
That came to my mind. That came to my mind. Yeah, but, yeah. But not them. Not the kids, but you have a father who's here, maybe illegally, maybe, you know, and so forth. Can that happen there? You know, maybe he did something 19 years ago they want to now make him an example. Mm. And I also thought we were being made an example of.
Mm. So one sports reporter for the Washington Post dubbed you the MVP coach. I agree. That was pretty courageous on your part.
I don't think, we have a young man on here who maritime, who's done real things in Africa, and he's been on the battlefront. Those are heroes. People in the military are our heroes. Those are heroes.
Not, all right. Well, let's say you're a profile in courage. Okay.
No, but that'd be Rosa Parks. You know. what I did, I don't think it's anything more special than anyone else who's read history, knows history, and knows as a Black person that you have to sometimes. My uncle is my idol. You know, my bishop as well. He said sometimes somebody's going to do something wrong to you, and even when they've hurt you, you got to stand up for them.
Well, there are African-American podcasters who are telling Blacks not to get involved in immigration protests, saying this is not your fight. What do you say to people who believe that?
Well, I've been attacked. I someone was telling me, you know, it's so funny because I have kids who are Latino, who are actually dire right-wing Republicans who I've coached for years. And they were telling me, you know, I was speaking to one yesterday, and he was telling me how, you know, on the chatter sphere that, you know, I'm being called an Uncle Tom in some aspects. My whole thing is, if you have to look at people's race, you have to look at people's religion, ethnicity, to be to be a human being, and humility in that situation, then you have being a human being all wrong. You know, we as Black people have never been people who have gone and hurt children. It is our nature, our ancestors' nature, to be nurturing. So that's sick.
You know, Coach, there's a famous poem by Pastor Martin Niemöller that goes, first they came for the socialists and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews. I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left
to speak for me.
You know that.
And that is true. There, once you start nitpicking about this race and that race, as opposed to just what is right and wrong, you know, the same people who are spouting those nonsenses, they would never let a white kid who's hanging off a balcony, who's 3 years old, stay on a balcony. They would go and do everything they could do. It has nothing to do with black or white or Latino or legal or non-legal. It has everything to be a decent human being, you know, a decent human being. You can't pick and choose the Bible. I always tell people the Bible talks about you hear the stranger knock at the door and you still open it. Awesome. You don't close it.
So, okay, Coach, on a more personal note, you're not a native Washingtonian, but you spent some time in the DMV, and I want our audience to know that. What are some of the
Yes, I loved it.
What are your best memories of DC?
Oh, I spent a half year. I went to Ballou High School in the Southeast. My love of really understanding football came when I went to go see Ballou against McKinley Tech and Coolidge.
Wait a minute. Coolidge, now that's when you get in my territory.
Strayhorn, you know, understanding that. Food there, love that as well. And the great jazz music there, and enjoyed that quite a bit. I used to go down and listen to Shirley Horn all the time when I was in the DMV. So when I was in DC. So it's part of my, people always say, where you from? I'm a Brooklyn kid, but there's DC still a part of me, very much so. And loved it there. And every time I can go there, it's not even a visit, it's home. It's home.
Now, what states are your parents from? Well, either of them from?
My mother's a Brooklyn girl and my father's from Pittsburgh.
Okay. So you're a coach, you have a master's degree in law, and I understand you have a singing career. What kind of singing do you do?
I've sung for, I always tell people whatever they pay me to do. but it stays within the R&B, gospel, jazz realm. You know, I got all those things. My mom was a great, phenomenal singer. And my aunts were great singers who sung with people like the Drinking Singers, who people won't know, but they had a daughter in there named Whitney Houston. they sang with people like Dionne Warwick. They sang with people like Sam Cooke and a lot of those people. So a lot of times on the Apollo, a lot of times on the Chitlin' Circuit. My father was a musician, so.
Oh, okay. So if I asked you to sing your favorite song, how would it sound?
In the morning, it would sound like that. my favorite song would always be Aretha, the GOAT. And it would be, yes, the greatest singer ever lived. It would be Holy Holy.
Holy Holy.
Holy Holy.
Okay, that's it. That's from your drawing from your gospel singing.
Well, in these days, you got to draw from something, man.
Yes, indeed.
If I can draw from Aretha, I'm happy to do that.
Okay. And any final thoughts, Coach?
I hope that people who hear this can understand that there's schemes out here to devalue people's human rights in this country. I live in Harlem, but if you go up 2 miles, it's a Dominican Republic basically up there. They have more people, 800,000 people live in that community. Outside of Dominican Republic, it's the most Dominicans, and they have schools up there. So my thing is, ISIS, are they going to come on those campuses and take those kids out and have their parents come through? And then everybody has to see if you're here legally, so those type of things. So now how is that a way to get kids out? Mm. So those are things we have to look out for.
Okay. MVP coach Yeoman Wilder, head of the Harlem Hitting Academy. I'm so honored to have you as my guest this morning, Coach Wilder.
I learned so much, and I appreciate it so much.
Thank you for joining me. Well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. Thanks to all of our guests, Professor Laura Dickinson and Jean Fidel and Commander Bobby Aura Jones and MVP coach Yeoman Wilder. Thank you to my engineer extraordinaire, Mike Masella. And thank you, the listener, our raison d'etre. Next week, Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo. Up next, Dr. Ife Williams with Wake Up and Stay Woke. I'm Verna Avery Brown. And in the words of the late, the great Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Ashe.
WPFW listeners. Summertime is here. Words, Beats, and Life has the event for your family and friends this season. The second annual DMV Made Festival is happening Saturday, July 26th on the National Mall, a one-day celebration of the D.C., Maryland, Virginia region, promoting the intersections of arts and culture. Music by Go-Go Legends, EU, featuring Sugar Bear, vocalist Navasha Deo, jazz fusion trio The Mastetics, Black Folks Don't Swim, Kamau, and much more. Plus Family Fun Zone, Poetry and Storytelling Pavilion, Interactive Dance Stage, Live Art Installations, Hands-On Workshops, and Health and Wellness Pavilion. July 26th on the National Mall. Full details at wblinc.org/DMVMade. See you there. Brought to you by Words, Beats, and Life with support from WPFW.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. For nearly 5 decades, support from listeners like you has kept WPFW's wheels rolling. In fact, the single largest category of donations comes from those who donate an unused car to the station. That's right, running or not. Even a car sitting idle that needs thousands of dollars in repairs can do wonders for WPFW. If you can't drive it, donate it. WPFW will get the proceeds, and you'll get a tax break. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
African Diaspora International Film Festival, Africa World Now Project, and GWU Africana Studies Program present the 18th Annual African Diaspora International Film Festival, D.C., August 1st to the 3rd, featuring a film on Walter Rodney, films on Black musical traditions, and more. Receptions and Q&As, ADIFFDC, from August 1st to the 3rd at the GWU Student Center. Tickets and schedule at nyadiff.org or at 212-864-1760. ADIFF, where Black Life Matters. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Birchmere presents Omar, July 17th. Hubert Laws, July 20th. Hiroshima, July 24th. And Sheila E., July 30th. Details at thebirchmere.com.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle.
Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Institute for Policy Studies, alongside the Wallace Global Fund, Public Citizen, and The Nation magazine, invite you to their second annual Henry Wallace Symposium, Bold Ideas for a New Progressive Majority, taking place on Thursday, July 17th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the University of California, Washington Center. Speakers include Representatives Pramila Jayapal, Greg Kassar, and Jamie Raskin, along with Lisa Gilbert of Public Citizen and IPS Executive Director Tope Falerin. That's the second annual Henry Wallace Symposium, Bold Ideas for a New Progressive Majority, on Thursday, July.